are the other goals. I think there was a question last year about whether investment funding for invasive species was really under protection in the Constitution. And that probably, as we found out in the first year when we went beyond the Outdoor Heritage Council recommendation and established, I think it was $2 million for the emerald ash borer. The committee felt very strongly that that was part of the constitutional charge in protecting. But I think some citizens might have had different opinions. And I think those conversations are still taking place. The committee went on after we established our investment goals in March of 2009. Then we went on to create the pamphlet which established principles and outcomes. Principles and outcomes for all four funds, and then for each fund individually. These are still posted. These are still, I recommend people that contact me to say, how can we get some of that legacy money, whether it's whatever funds it's in. And I tell them to start with the principles and goals. If what they're going to use that legacy money for doesn't meet the principles and goals of the fund and of the overall goals. And I think that that's a good guide for them to begin with. I was, as chair and as the committee members, worked so hard in those 2 years on all this structure. I think a disappointment that still to this day the Senate hasn't adopted that structure, or even the structure of having a committee. But they seem to be happy with the way they're running things, so I guess we can go forth with the way we're running our part. I don't know for sure what more you want, but one of the things that I saw that I want to bring up, because I've never had the opportunity to before, is that in the first go-round, the people that worked so hard to get the amendment adopted did not want to question at all if everything that was coming out of, like, the Clean Water Council, or out of the Outdoor Heritage Council, or out of the Parks and Trails, or out of the Arts, they didn't want to question anything about that the decision makers were making. And as a result, one of the projects in the Upper Mississippi Valley project that was negotiated with, and we were not part of the negotiations at all. We either had to accept all or not. For that project, which gave many people the use of vast areas of land and property, we gave to the company in Finland that owns the land. The carbon and wetland credits forever. So if there's ever to be made money off of those carbon credits or wetland credits, that was a negotiated deal that the conferees that in the conference committee were just supposed to go. And trying to get help from the stakeholders that had been part of the alliance that passed the vote yes bill, they didn't want to make any ripples. And I was disappointed that DNR said, let it go. And I just think we should watch in the future those kind of things, because I think the agency that's responsible to the Minnesota citizens should have control of things like carbon and wetland credits. The thing that I think I have the most feedback on is the heritage and arts and culture and historical heritage. I think that for the most part, the majority of grants have been are impacting people statewide. Majority of the grants are tiny, $1,000, $1,500, $900, $700, $30,000. They're going to artists. They're bringing people of great talents to all parts of Minnesota. People within the regional art councils are thrilled to death, and every single member of the committee and of the legislature that was part of the legacy committee should be, and were invited to the Historical Society, because just last month they opened their first big exhibit based on the legacy funding that they got, and the exhibit is called Wow. And that's because from what we heard from the people, how the money should be spent were not for the ordinary daily kind of things they've always been doing, but for extraordinary things, and to bring Minnesotans a new way of looking at arts and culture and history kind of stuff. And so we should make our way over there and see, wow.
Okay, thank you. And I'll second that. I went there with my grandkids who were visiting, age 5 through 10, and they had a fantastic time running through all parts of it. And since they're French speaking, they were even nice to find some part of it was written in French about the voyageurs. So that was it. The one of the things that I've done, I think I didn't like it when I first saw it. I thought it should have had a better design. But the legacy logo appears all over. It's a little hard to understand all the elements of it. It's kind of like a scrambled colored mass, but it's very visible. You see it on things when you see it. And I've been noticing where it is. And one of the most recent legacy events that I just wandered into it, not because I thought it was a legacy event. It was kind of on my way home from the dentist, and I went by the Minneapolis Public Library, and I think it was the perfect combination of things. It was an exhibit on the photographer, the early photographer, McDonald, I hope you saw it, the early photographer who did, famous for pictures of American Indians at a time when no one was doing that. He was criticized by anthropologists, too, about not seriously portraying them, and it was a perfect example, and then there was a movie of his life, too. This was something that Legacy just put a little bit into, obviously, the movie was made by, I think, the Arts or History Councils of California or Arizona, but it was just the perfect example of our history, culture, libraries, all in one place. And it was totally, I was there on a weekday, and I had a nice kind of empty room to go. My husband went on a weekend, and he couldn't sit. It was so full of people. So I think, you know, just keep looking for that logo wherever you see it, and you'll be amazed at the kinds of things that give credit. I don't know the amounts, and obviously some of the things that we get to do is we get to leverage funding. And one principle I'd like to, and I've sort of stated it privately lots of places, so I'm not afraid to state it publicly now, is that every one of these committees and every one of these things need to remember that they're advisory to the legislature. And we might think that what they've done is exactly perfect and should be done in exactly that way, and then we'll do it. But if we want to change things, it is within our right. Legacy funds are not spent unless they're spent by law, and the only people who spend things by law are legislators signed by the governor. So that's, I want to put that. You know, of course, I'm one member of the committee, but I do want to put that out as a principle that I hope other people will adhere to. Okay. Representative Erdahl.
All right. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And just along the line of exhibits, another one opening is at the Science Museum shortly. It's in February, dealing with the Bishop Whipple and Native American artifacts, which I look forward to seeing. I've been, of course, my background, I'm a history teacher, so naturally interested in a lot of the purview of this committee. And actually, I was kind of the precursor to the Legacy Committee was Chairman Yaros and the Heritage Committee. And I actually served on that for a couple of years as well. So I was Legacy before, when Legacy wasn't cool.
when it didn't have money.
That's right. That's what I meant. But then served 2 years, the first 2 years of Legacy with Chair Murphy, and appreciated all of the things that she did. It's of course this is an evolving process, but Representative Murphy had to do the first of a lot of things, and when you are setting precedent and you are a groundbreaker, it's a very challenging experience, and I thought that Chair Murphy did an excellent job at that. Then when I became chair the last couple of years, again, as I said, recognized that the process is evolving, it is changing, it will continue to. You will be making Chair Kahn will be making changes from what we did before, but hopefully as we go through this process, it builds and becomes better and stronger. And that's what I hope to help happen. And just following up on what Chair Kahn was just saying, yes, these councils are advisory, and, you know, we did tweak some things. We made some minor changes in the last couple of years, and one thing that when Representative Murphy was chair, I put into the bill that just because an entity gets money one time, they should not anticipate that this is forever or for the life of this of the legacy amendment. And that's, you know, something that everyone should keep in mind. There's no guarantee that the funding go on forever. Things that we try to emphasize this last couple of years, you know, the transparency, and I know that, Chair Kahn is concerned as well. It was my goal that we establish the website and other methods that that the monies that are dispersed through this committee can be tracked, you know, from the beginning through the whole process. And I think we're getting closer. There's, you know, still work to do with that. We had a presentation to us just last week that deals with more openness and how to continue the process to do that. I think that we, you know, are attempting to fairly distribute funds to work on the reporting systems. I learned a lot last couple of years. Learned how to put a bill together as a chairman. Then I learned how to do it all over again. I learned how to, I know that Ms. Taylor remembers how we do it all over again. I learned how to sit for 6 hours listening to a debate on my bill and then see it pass with hardly any changes in special session. I learned that the Senate isn't particularly easy to work with, no matter who's in charge. I learned all about the legislative...
When we get to the Senate this year, the person who's going to be in charge of the legacy is Representative Cohen, and what you can remember is that I taught him everything he knows.
Yeah, he told me that once. I learned about the differences between the legislative open meeting law and the executive open meeting law. Challenges remain before us yet, and some of them a little bit vexing. I'm sure we will still be facing the challenges of, you know, purchases of land and PILT payments and how to meet the needs of local units of government with those. The issues of supplementing versus supplanting will never go away, probably. But the biggest, most vexing issue to me over those 2 years were how to divide up Parks and Trails money. And one of the things that we did do was to establish a task force to, over the interim, work on that and to come up with a foolproof system that everyone will agree to so that we can fund Parks and Trails fairly into the future. I'm sure that that's been done. Isn't that right, Mr. Rice?
Yeah, I'm sure we're going to have a hearing on that, too.
No, I think that a good effort was put forward, but I don't think that we've reached the kumbaya moment of that issue yet. But, you know, we've tried, and it just is a very difficult issue for a lot of reasons, and I'm sure in the committee hearing they will all be coming out again. Just a few things that, you know, we keep in mind about this. You know, in essence, with our roughly $600 million the last biennium, in some ways it's like a mini bonding bill in some areas of the things that we do. There are jobs in the legacy bill, in legacy funding. And, you know, I'm proud of the 4 years that I've served on this committee, of getting, you know, roughly, I don't know, $120 million or so dollars back to taxpayers, to improving the transparency, to starting the restoration of the state capitol, which was in the bill a couple of years ago. At least partially establishing aquatic invasive species in the Sorenson Center, and with Representative Wiginius's help on that one. And for those in the public or in the legislature, you know, we keep getting this, everything's partisan. And can't you work together? I think the examples in this committee of Representative Torkelson and Representative Wiginius and I and others working together on the AIS project, I think, is a good example that we do work together to try to get good things done for the people of Minnesota. A lot more to do, but we've made improvements in our studies of waters and streams and the impairment issues. We have more to do with preserving land and with preserving historic sites, our culture, and I look forward to continuing to work on this next couple of years with Chair Kahn and the rest of you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions? Anyone? Any comments? I know I have many of the people in the audience, I've had great disappointment that they didn't get their expected homework assignments and things like that. So I guess I really apologize to them for that. And I do want to also, this is to people in the audience who are, I know that some committees, before anything is considered, want a bill to be introduced. I am not going to insist on that. If you want to introduce a bill for any reason, for the extra transparency and the extra visibility, that's fine. If you just want to get a proposal into us, you hopefully we'll have a website that will give those proposals the kind of prominence that that introducing a bill would get. Sorry, I'm a fiscal conservative by nature, and the idea of all that green and yellow paper going through the system when it's never going to appear in a final form kind of offends me. So, but you can, again, just general principle, if people are thinking that they have to start to get a bill drawn and they have to start to find authors and that kind of thing, that's not going to be necessary. Are there any questions or comments from other members of the committee? I'd be terrified to say something after Murphy and Erdahl also. Okay. Okay, the next thing is we're going to look at the first piece of transparency that we did. And if you need more time for this, Jim, we'll just extend it on to another meeting. Oh, wait a minute. Did we have... No, I'm sorry, Jeanette. Additional remarks, I'm sorry. The longest serving staff member of the biggest part of this, so I wanted, sorry that I passed over you. Let's come in. And
thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the chair just wanted me to provide any additional comments following the two chairs in case I thought there was any big omissions or just sort of my general comments, since I have been providing staffing to the Legacy Division or committee since its inception in some sort of capacity. I also provide staffing assistance to the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council and sit in on all their meetings. So I'm fairly familiar with what they do, but you know, they're great if you want to ever get some detailed information. I encourage you to work with them. I think both Chair Erdahl and Chair Murphy did a good sort of laying the groundwork for what the committee has in front of you. As been mentioned, you're going to get recommendations for the Outdoor Heritage Council annually. You're going to get recommendations on the Parks and Trails Fund this year. This is just the one time, and it may be up to the committee to kind of establish a new framework, kind of as Chair Erdahl had mentioned, and then you will get recommendations from the Clean Water Council. A lot of the like policy work has been done. In my opinion, the House has spent a lot more deliberate work kind of setting the foundation for how we use these funds. We've done a lot of work on the reporting. Administrative costs have been a big issue here. Also, you know, the transparency of the website, that's all sort of been the house initiative. And I don't know if those issues have been solved, but I would expect them to continue to sort of be raised here. I would echo what Chair Erdahl said, that it isn't as partisan as some other committees that you may work on. It is kind of fun. It is kind of a cooperative environment. And, I'm here to help them. Like I said, I cover the natural resources type areas. I also work with Representative Wiginius and her committee and Representative Dill in the policy committee. So I have some expertise in that area. So that's what I'll had to add, unless there's anything in particular you wanted me to cover.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, Mr. Noble.
Madam Chair, I'm Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and I really appreciate you inviting us and having this opportunity to visit with you. With me at the table is Judy Randall, who is an evaluation manager in the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and she is going to present to you a report we issued in 2011, which I think is still a really good primer for anyone who is new to the legacy amendment issues. It really lays out the background, the history, the structure, and also presents to you some of the issues, which we called ongoing issues, and Judy's going to cover that presentation. And then Cecile Ferkel is the Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Financial Audit Division. And when the legacy amendment passed, we immediately knew that there was going to be a lot of opportunity and a lot of responsibility on all of us. And I have to say my words of praise, too, for the two previous chairs, who I think, from our perspective at the Office of the Legislative Auditor, really approached that area of responsibility for accountability, transparency, and oversight in a very thoughtful way. And it was quite bipartisan, I would say that as well. And working with Representative Erdahl and then advancing into more of the details about how we control administrative costs and all of those things. And so it's really been a wonderful opportunity for us at the Office of the Legislative Auditor to be a part of this venture with you. Now, your role, of course, is to figure out how to spend the money. And as some of you have already mentioned, and you will find out if you haven't been on this committee, it's sometimes just as hard to spend money as it is to cut budgets. There's been a lot of cutting, but this committee and the legacy amendment has presented you with an opportunity to spend additional money. But there are a lot of competing interests and desires for the money, and so you will find that there are a lot of tough decisions to make along the way. The role of the Office of the Legislative Auditor is to extend and strengthen, to the degree that we can, the oversight that starts here before this committee and in the Senate committee. But what we can offer you is the ability to send staff deep into the organizations that receive this money. We have that authority in statute. We have that responsibility. It's part of what we do every day for all of the funds that are appropriated by the legislature. But we have taken, I would say, a special sense of responsibility for the money that comes from the legacy funds, because it really is here because of the voice of the people with both an authorization but very high expectations, again, about accountability. They said, yes, we will tax ourselves more for certain specific purposes, and they laid out those purposes in the amendment, and they said that they wanted this money, as has already been alluded to supplement and not supplant other appropriations. And that's a very difficult standard to completely understand what that means and how to implement it. Judy Randall, again, is going to talk about some of these issues. I just thought I would mention very briefly that in addition to doing reports that are directly about the legacy amendment and the funds and audits that Ms. Ferkel is going to talk about, we have done other evaluations, and I'm confident we will continue to do them, that are relevant. And you may not think of them as directly related to the legacy funds, but they really are. One of the reports we issued, for example, in 2010 was on the management of natural resource lands, which is very much a part of, frankly, the controversy that has been referenced. The state already owns a lot of land. There are implications for the state and government owning land. And what we found in this report is that the legislature and the executive branch needed to do a better job of managing the land that we already have. And so here's a report that is also relevant for you, again, particularly some of you who are new to these issues, that might be a good primer. Another report that I think is relevant is on watershed management and the reference to issues about water. The structure that we have in Minnesota for managing our watersheds is very complicated. It involves a partnership between the state and an array of local units of government, and frankly, sometimes it's a little bit hard to figure out who does what. And again, this report will help you just as a basic primer on that structure. Another report we issued very directly in response to Representative Murphy was on public libraries. Again, recipients of some legacy money, and again, some concern and controversy about the structure that we have in some parts of the state to provide public library services. The final report I would mention is one that actually Ms. Randall was a manager of, and which I think has had a tremendous impact throughout state government. And that was a report on state grant management to nonprofit organizations. We do a lot of this. We do millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in grants every year, not only from legacy funds, but from many other funds. And frankly, we didn't think we were doing a very good job of managing those grants. And so we proposed back a number of years ago that this ought to be a topic for the legislative auditor to evaluate, and we produced this report in 2007. And as a result of that report, an Office of Grants Management was created in the Department of Administration. Some policies were established, and I think we have improved the grants management process across state government. But I also know from work that you're going to hear about that there is more to be done. When we take public funds and give it to a nonprofit organization, there are strings attached. It is still public money, and there still ought to be a level of transparency and accountability for that money, even though it is in the hands of, essentially, of a private organization. And finally, I would just mention that one of the tools that we can bring to bear for you in your efforts at in-depth oversight is that the Office of the Legislative Auditor has not only responsibility for a lot of audit work, but we have very powerful legal tools. We can go into any organization that receives public money, public or private. We do have subpoena power, which we use on occasion. There is statutory authority that really compels people to produce all documents, all records to us that we need to see to do an audit. So that's a tool that we have, and we are eager to use it to help you in your efforts as well. With that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn to Ms. Randall for a brief presentation of our report overview of the legacy amendment. Okay.
First, a question or comment from Representative Murphy.
Mr. Noble, the Pilt report, too.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, the Pilt issue is addressed in our report on land management. And again, it is one of those controversies, and there is a whole chapter in this report just on Pilt and the complexities of Pilt. I think I use that word a lot every time I talk about the issues in these reports, and you have to do it too, that word complex. I sometimes wonder, are you ever going to give us just a simple topic to look at? Maybe not. Maybe there aren't any. But Pilt is in this report as well.
Okay. Any other? Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall, and I'm with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And I'm pleased to be here today to talk with you about our legacy amendment evaluation. As Mr. Nobles mentioned, this report was released in November of 2011, so it's a little over a year old, but I think as an overview, it still is useful. So let me just provide a quick overview of the legacy amendment. I know some of you have heard this presentation before, and for some of you, this is old news, but hopefully it'll provide a useful refresher or some new information for the newer members. So the legacy amendment is a constitutional amendment. It was passed by the voters in 2008, and essentially the amendment raised the state sales tax by 0.375% and dedicated that money for specific purposes that were also outlined in the amendment. The amendment, or the sales tax, is projected to raise between $240 and $300 million annually, and it was approved for 25 years, so it's set to expire June 30th, 2034. If you do the math, 25 years times the $240 to $300, you quickly find out that the amendment is expected to raise between $6.25 and $7.5 billion over the 25 years. So it's a significant amount of money. In addition to raising the state sales tax, the legacy amendment established four funds and allocated the percentage of the sales tax revenue to each of those funds. So you can see the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the Clean Water Fund each receive a third of the revenue raised through the sales tax. And then the Parks and Trails Fund and the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund split the remaining third, although not in equal shares. The amendment also establishes purposes for each of the funds, purposes for how the money allocated to each of those funds may be used. So just to walk through those quickly, so the Outdoor Heritage Fund is intended to restore, protect, and enhance prairies, forests, habitat, wetlands. The Clean Water Fund is intended to protect, enhance, and restore groundwater, surface water, and drinking water. Parks and Trails Fund is intended to support parks and trails of regional or statewide significance. And then the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, which I think may be the broadest one, is for arts, arts education, arts access, and to preserve Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. So it's a quick overview of what the amendment did and its funds, but hopefully that gets us all on the same pages, same page. Now to talk about how that money actually kind of flows into the state government and out, I'm going to put up a pretty messy slide, frankly. So on page 43 of the report in front of you, you should all hopefully have a copy of the report in front of you. The slide is also on page 43, so it may be easier to follow there, but I'll try to walk us through it relatively quickly. So the first step is that the sales tax, the money is generated. And in fiscal year 2012, it was about $265 million. Just a side note, last year when the report was produced in 2011, it generated $250 million. So this year it's $265 million. So that amount is going up. The sales tax revenue comes into the state treasury, and then it goes out to the four funds in those percentages outlined previously. So a third to Outdoor Heritage Fund, a third to the Clean Water Fund, and then again the remaining third split, although not evenly, between the other two funds. So far everything is the same for these four funds, but this is where we get to some differences. So two of the funds, the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the Clean Water Fund, have an advisory council. As Madam Chair mentioned, there's two advisory councils. The other two funds do not have formal advisory councils outlined in law. I just want to pause here a minute because these two advisory councils are different from each other in important ways. So the Outdoor Heritage Fund has the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. It's an advisory council established in the legislative branch. There are legislators that serve on it, and they are voting members. And the Outdoor Heritage Council goes through a pretty rigorous process every year to review proposed projects. They vet the projects. They rank the projects. They go through, a pretty elaborate process to then ultimately make recommendations back to the legislature on how funding from the Outdoor Heritage Fund should be spent. But again, as Madam Chair mentioned, these are simply recommendations, and of course it's this committee and the legislature as a whole that ultimately decides how that money is appropriated. The Clean Water Fund has the Clean Water Council as its advisory council. That council actually predates the Legacy Amendment and was established in 2006 for the Clean Water Legacy Act. This is an advisory council that's established in the executive branch. There are legislators that serve on that council, but they are non-voting members. And it has a different function than the Lessard-Sams Council. Rather than reviewing and vetting specific projects, instead they kind of look at a more programmatic basis and make broader program-based recommendations to the legislature in terms of how Clean Water Fund money should be allocated. The Parks and Trails Fund and the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund don't have formal advisory councils in the same way. As was mentioned earlier, the Parks and Trails Fund did have kind of an ad hoc group established in the previous years to help provide some insight, as Chair Erdahl said, in terms of how the Parks and Trails Fund should be allocated. For now, the Parks and Trails Fund money is allocated on a formula basis. So a pot goes to parks and trails of state significance, a pot goes to parks and trails in the metropolitan area, and then a pot goes to parks and trails for outside of the metropolitan area. The exact allocation of that money is a work in progress, if that's a fair comment, Chair Erdahl. And then finally, the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund does not have an advisory council either. Some of the money from that fund is allocated kind of directly in law, recipients are named, but larger pots are allocated to the Minnesota State Arts Board and the Minnesota Historical Society, which has existing grants processes, kind of keying off what Chair Murphy said in terms of leveraging existing systems and processes in place. Those organizations had comprehensive grants management, grants allocation processes in place, and Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund money takes advantage of that expertise. So at the end of the day, whether it's an advisory council or through other means, the recommendations go to the legislature in terms of how the money should be appropriated. And again, ultimately, it's the legislature that decides how that money is allocated. In past years, more than 13 state agencies have received money from the Legacy Fund. And then the money ultimately goes out through the state agencies to the ultimate recipients of the legacy money. That may be the state agencies themselves, or it may be a nonprofit organization. It's important to note that even if a nonprofit organization is mentioned in law as the recipient of the money, that money must first flow through a state agency that serves as the fiscal agent for the funds. It was kind of a messy slide. Hopefully you all stuck with me through that. The key really is that there are some differences among those four funds. First is advisory groups. Two of the funds have an advisory group, two of them don't, and the two advisory groups themselves differ. Secondly, how the money is allocated. Again, the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council provides one example in terms of a comprehensive review process, specific recommendations to the legislature, and then the money is appropriated, compared to how the Parks and Trails money is allocated really on a formula basis. And then finally, the amount of oversight that's provided also varies among the four funds. The Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, again to name them, provides significant oversight of the recipients of money from the Outdoor Heritage Fund. In contrast, the Clean Water Council does not provide the same level of oversight of recipients from the Clean Water Fund, of recipients of money from the Clean Water Fund. And money that's allocated through the other funds may be subject more to internal state agency oversight rather than external oversight. So there are some differences. The differences in large part reflect some of the history of the funds, the existing expertise in state government when the legacy amendment was established. And that's fine. We don't think all four funds need to be exactly the same. But we did find some common themes across all of the four funds. And as Mr. Nobles mentioned earlier, we kind of identified them as some ongoing concerns that apply to all four of the funds. And I'll talk about each of them in a little more detail, but just to give you the overview. So one of the ongoing concerns is, are we achieving what we wanted to with the money? Are we getting the outcomes we desired? The second one is compliance with the supplement, not substitute requirement that's outlined in the amendment. Concerns about conflicts of interest, which I think will persist throughout the life of the legacy amendment. And then how to handle administrative expenses. And this is something that the committee has worked hard on over the past couple of years. So let me first start with the first one in terms of outcome and whether we're going to achieve what we're hoping to achieve with legacy money. And it's not clear at this point. It's still early in the game, though. And for each of the funds, maybe there's a different concern about the outcome. So regarding the Outdoor Heritage Fund, as Mr. Nobles was talking about, a decent amount of the money has been used at least so far to purchase more land, so publicly owned land. And there's already concerns, as outlined in our 2010 report, about the amount of state land, the amount of land the state already owns and the state's ability to effectively manage it. So those concerns are going to continue as long as Outdoor Heritage Fund money is continued to be used for purchasing more land. Regarding the Clean Water Fund.
This is a complicated issue. So if anyone has a question as Ms. Randall's going along, just we'll try and recognize you instead of waiting until the end when she may be on a totally different subject. Sorry to interrupt.
That's fine. Thank you, Madam Chair. Absolutely. It's complicated and every fund is different and there's really a lot of nuanced issues within each fund. Regarding the Clean Water Fund, I think there's concerns that money is being used to measure and monitor water rather than produce some measurable outcomes to clean water quicker and more measurably. Regarding the Parks and Trails Fund, there's concerns that the money is being used simply to maintain existing parks and trails rather than to enhance the parks and trails or create new parks and trails and add new parks and trails to the system. Finally, regarding the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, there are questions that maybe some of the money is being used for projects of maybe marginal significance that don't necessarily line up with the state's priorities. So this is an ongoing concern for which we don't have recommendations. I'm sorry. It's more just to kind of put them on your radar screen and to acknowledge that these are concerns that are going to persist, we probably, I think, throughout the life of the Legacy Fund. And it's just something to, I think, pay attention to and monitor as you go forward. There's a question.
Representative Hassan. Thank you, Madam Chair. To that, the Parks and Trails issue, if currently we are not maintaining existing parks and trails, we're ignoring them, then wouldn't that seem reasonable to do it with this? Because then we're not supplanting because we're not doing it. I mean, if wouldn't that be an argument? As opposed to continuing to use bonding to build them. We have another tool to build, but we don't have another tool to maintain.
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, I think it's a really good point. And what's interesting with Parks and Trails in particular is the purpose outlined in the amendment is different for Parks and Trails. The language says it's to support Parks and Trails. And so Parks and Trails, I think there's a desire out there for people to want to have either more parks and trails or enhanced amenities at existing parks and trails. But the language in the amendment, I think, does allow for what you're saying, because the language says support. I do think, and I'm going to get into a discussion about the supplement versus substitute, I think there's some questions there. I don't have the right, the one answer. But, for example, if legacy money is being used to repair boardwalks that go through a marsh in a state park, I'm kind of making this up, but I think that's a reasonable thing. Is that supplanting? Do we have that boardwalk? How were we going to replace that boardwalk anyways? Shouldn't we have had existing funds to do it? But if we don't, and the legacy amendment language says it's to support parks and trails, then maybe that's allowed. I mean, I know I talked in circles, but I think this illustrates kind of the questions and ambiguities that surround the amendment.
Madam Chair, if I could just add one thing to Representative Hausman, because I think it brings up another issue that I know everybody in this audience, in this room, cares a lot about, and that is that we do not want to get ourselves in a situation where we are using legacy money in a way that we become dependent on that as the source of money to do things that are going to be ongoing responsibilities. This is a 25-year authorization. It will run out. 25 years is a long time. We've already run through several of those. But if we cannot find some other source of revenue to sustain and support the parks and trail system that we have, and maybe additions to that that we put on with legacy money, we're going to get to the end. Now, some of you may actually be here. I'm not sure I will be. Maybe I will be. But that's an issue, and I think it's been raised in a number of areas, but specifically with parks and trails. Let's not see this as money that will be there forever to do things that will be a responsibility forever.
Okay. Any other? All right.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just continuing to our next ongoing concern, and it's related point here about how to comply with the supplement not substitute provision that's in the amendment. And that's kind of how it's either sometimes called supplement not supplant, supplement not substitute. This is kind of the shorthand. But the amendment requires the legacy money to supplement and not substitute for quote-unquote traditional sources of funding. That may seem okay on its face, but really the language in the Constitution has led to a number of questions. Most notably, well, what constitutes a traditional source of funding? How long does an agency need to have been receiving money from another source for it to be considered traditional? It's not exactly clear in the way the language is written. The other point that's of note here is that the amendment doesn't require maintaining a traditional level of funding. It's simply maintaining that traditional source of funding. So working this out and what it means is has been confusing for many folks. We do have some recommendations regarding the provision. One is to the legislature to consider establishing a process, kind of like a fiscal note process, whereby you can get information on the previous funding levels and sources on specific projects. So if an agency comes before you and says, I'd like $100,000 to do Project X, you would have a process where you could say, well, is Project X new or has it already been in place? And if it's already been in place, where has that money come? Where was that money from? You know, how long had you been receiving that money? How much money had you been receiving? So to give you kind of an institutionalized process to get more information. The other recommendation that we have is to the recipients of the legacy money that they need to document how they're complying with this provision. Even though it's not clear, even though it's vague, it can't be ignored. So we think it's important for the recipients of the money to do due diligence and to make a real effort to kind of to demonstrate how they're complying with it. Again, it's not necessarily clear and easy to do, but we do think that everybody needs to take it seriously. The third ongoing concern is regarding conflicts of interest. And this is a concern that has in the past been focused on the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council in particular, where there's a number of stakeholders who have, you know, who are stakeholders in the purposes of the Outdoor Heritage Council or Outdoor Heritage Fund, but that's exactly why they're on the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. So the nature of the council itself almost sets up these concerns. But the conflict of interest concerns persist, I think, across all of the funds. And one thing that's interesting is there's different opinions about what constitutes the conflict of interest. And not only are there different opinions, but there are actually different laws and policies about what is a conflict of interest. And the laws and policies differ depending on the specifics of the case, and it also differs depending on which fund we're talking about and who we're talking about. So when we're talking about conflicts of interest, it's really important to get to the specifics. When we did our evaluation, the only concern we had was with the Clean Water Council at the time that hadn't paid close enough attention to the conflict of interest concerns. So our first recommendation, not surprisingly, was to the Clean Water Council to develop conflict of interest policies and procedures, and I'm happy to say that they responded really very quickly. So this evaluation was released in November 2011. By January 2012, they had already taken action on this and developed conflict of interest policies and implemented procedures. So I think this recommendation seems to have been taken care of. But more generally, we also recommend to all state agencies and kind of everybody involved in implementing the legacy amendment that conflict of interest concerns are real and need to really be given serious consideration going forward. The final ongoing concern I'm going to touch on is related to administrative expenses. And again, this is something that the committee over the last couple of years has spent a lot of time on. Right now, the law requires administrative expenses to be, this is the language, directly related to and necessary for legacy-funded activity.
That's not, let me just put it in here, that's not part of the constitutional amendment. Is that part of the enabling law, or was it part of a legacy bill that, one of the legacy bills? I know law is law no matter where it comes from, but sure. Just...
Madam Chair, and Chair Erdahl also will be able to shed some light on this, but my understanding is that this was the language in place for money from the Outdoor Heritage Fund initially, and then money from other funds had kind of different language. There was some trial with percentage caps and different ways of handling administrative expenses, and in 2011, I believe, the law was changed. So it's in the statutes. It's not in the Constitution, as you said, Madam Chair, and this now applies to all four funds, but Chair Erdahl has lived and breathed this, so.
Representative, you want to live and breathe
you.
It to us?
Thank you, Chair Kahn. It's just one of the little vexing problems that we had that, yes, we did spend a lot of time with, and the description is accurate. You know, there was concern that from what had been set earlier, that, what was it, 2%?
Yeah.
Yeah, that wasn't adequately meeting their needs, and that they needed a higher percentage. We were concerned. I mean, they were talking 5-10%. We were struggling over how to come up with a percentage that would work. And no matter what amount we set or what way we set, it was somebody objected. Wasn't enough, was too much, whatever. So we hit upon this and put into statute that it has to be, directly related to the project and as it says, directly related to and necessary for the legacy funding activity. And then we said, I think it's in, I don't know if it's in statute or not, but this will be evaluated, and if it, frankly, if it's not successful, we'll revisit it. And again, if that's not a statute, our intent was that we would look this over, and if they were abusing the administrative fund, we would. I think I said to him, "We'll go back to doing a percentage. We'll probably set something that won't be liked." So anyway, as I struggle to explain it, I struggle to do it in the first place.
I guess this is an issue I was even familiar with before I was in the legislature, since I worked on grants and worked at the university and looked at the university's system for indirect costs. I mean, at the I think I simultaneously had a grant from a federal agency at the same time that my husband, who's a mathematician and required nothing except a blackboard, which I think he had to erase himself if he wanted it erased, and I was working in a lab that required all kinds of extra stuff done to it, even when I hadn't done anything wrong, like spill some radioactive material or or anything like that. And I think the university's overhead requirement at that time was, you know, close to 50% of the cost of the grant, which you got a grant, and then they build the agency for it. At some point, I switched to my granting agency became the American Cancer Society, and the American Cancer Society, in order to give the grant to the university, just said, I may be making up these numbers because I don't know how well I remember them, said, you know, our top administrative expense is 20%. And does the university say, no, you have to do 50%? They said, no, that's fine. We'll take whatever you give us. So it is, I'm not projecting that we go to any of those kinds of numbers, but it is, you know, I do think we do have to recognize that if a department or an agency of state government or any public agency has a lot of additional work to do, and we want that work done properly, you know, we may need to pay them for it. And we have to remember at this time, everybody's budgets are strained from all directions. So we may have to revisit how we can determine what appropriate administrative expenses are. And I think my instinct is that definition is a little tight.
Madam Chair, could I also, though, add to the discussion, and I just, for those of you who are new to this, particularly Representative Erdahl's committee spent hours and hours, so we could get deep into this, and I won't, but we also, in terms of doing compliance audit work, have to pay attention to the constitutional provision.
Sure.
Because if agencies start saying, well, we have this grant, and yes, we have administrative expenses, and part of that is the rent and the utilities and things that they had been paying for over the years from other sources. All of a sudden, we're using legacy money for just general operations of state government. And I think clearly could run afoul, not just of the wisdom of Representative Erdahl's language, but of the Constitution itself, with the possibility that you could indeed, and what often hangs over this issue, is that with a constitutionally dedicated fund, there are interests out there that frankly are willing to come and sue you for the constitutional violation if you're simply using this money for purposes that are not authorized under the Constitution.
I know there are a couple of members who want to say something, but another member just joined the committee, and I'd like to give him a chance to introduce himself.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Torkelson from District 16B. This is my third term on the Legacy Committee.
Okay, great. And I think you did a lot of work with the clean water section of it, was that?
Yes.
So you came at just the very appropriate time. Okay.
And, may I also comment, he did work on the county fairs as well.
Okay. All right. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification for Mr. Nobles. In some of these funds that are allocated for a project, isn't there a percentage that should be a maximum that would be used for admin? Is that how it's been traditionally done, or is it how is that process? And if the answer is in the audit, then you could just point me to the page, and I'll do some research tonight.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, you make a good point there at the end. I do want to refer all of you to our report on all of the issues that Ms. Randall's covering. There's a lot more detail on conflict of interest, on the supplement, not supplant. There's also on administrative costs, which starts on page 53. And Representative McDonald, specific to your question, just kind of echoing what I think Representative Erdahl said, we've tried two basic different approaches. We did try, in law, you tried, inserting a percentage to say you can have 2%, 2.5%, 3%. It did vary some for administrative costs. And there were, as Representative Erdahl said, there were complaints about that. It wasn't enough. And also, I think it was possible that even on some pass-through grants, you might not need 2%. There is, on some, you might need 8%. So, again, Representative Erdahl, after listening to many people, different points of view, came to the conclusion that we would give agencies some discretion, or other recipients, including nonprofits, to show that they could use either 0.5% or 5%. It could vary, as long as they could demonstrate and document that those costs were directly related to and necessary for fulfilling the purposes of that grant. Now, you still get into a lot of complexities, even with that language. And one of the things that we do in our audit work, and Ms. Perkle can talk about this in some detail, is that we go out to the agencies and we say, okay, you got this $100,000 or $5 million or whatever it is. We want you to be able to demonstrate to us that the costs in that you expended from that grant for things that you identify and we agree are administrative costs were, in fact, directly related to and necessary to that grant. And you get into a lot of complexities. Agencies will argue with us, frankly, that we should allow them to include certain expenses as directly related to and necessary for that we might think really were not, that they're part of the ongoing responsibility of the operation of that agency and shouldn't be charged the legacy funds. And again, you will see some of that debate in our report, where we actually quote from some of the commissioners saying that the approaches that the legislature has taken and the legislative auditor has imposed upon them are unreasonable. I think the bottom line, though, for you as policymakers, is that the voters, again, passed this authorization to tax themselves to do things above and beyond what were already being done, not to simply have another pot of money to support the general operations of state government. So there is tension there. Agency budgets have been cut over the last number of years. A lot of the general fund money, for example, in the Department of Natural Resources, and you will hear this from them, their general fund appropriation for supporting their general operations has been declining. And most of what they have now are pots of money that are dedicated to specific purposes, including legacy money. Where do they fund their general operations? So they try to design a system of saying, we'll dock these different dedicated funds a certain percent to fund the rent, to fund the utilities, to fund a variety of overhead things. A very long answer. I said, Representative Erdahl, he's the authority on this. He spent hours dealing with this issue. And it will never be fully settled, I'm afraid.
Representative. Let me just comment on that,
sure.
Please. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, of course, the ultimate arbitrator was going to be them as far as determining the actual use. So if we had questions, Mr. Knowles was going to help us with the answer.
Although even as far as their advice is, we take it as advice also. We may have to change the law sometimes to deal with it. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, just from a different perspective on this issue was, if I remember correctly, we used that principle that existing funding systems and some money was granted with the department or with the council, Humanities Council, and they were the pass-through for grants, and yet then State Department's committee cut Humanities that same year, the Humanities Council's budget. And so they did not receive as much money as they had anticipated coming in, and so the grants were passed through, but they had higher administrative costs with no place to make up the money. So some of their ordinary functions were threatened because they had administered the pass-through grants. And so we've got to have more communication with the pass-through or the existing funding system if we're going to put caps on or if we're going to be very limited in those administrative costs.
Mr. Nobles, we've got about 5 minutes left. Do you want to come back? We'll probably have you back again at some point. Do you think we should do a schedule again, or can
Madam Chair, let's
finish?
Do it this way. Ms. Randall can finish up, I think, and win that time, and then we'll come back to cover our financial audit work,
okay,
which will really get you deep into some details, which, frankly,
okay,
I think you'll want to hear.
Good.
That is when we really go and put these general principles to a very detailed test and come back with some findings that I think will be relevant for you to hear.
Okay, that's a good separation. I know sometimes we're going to have to go later, but I'd hate to start right away if we can possibly finish in time. Ms. Randall.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think I can wrap this up quite quickly. I think we've covered this issue, so I'm just going to jump to our recommendations related to administrative expenses. Basically, we think legacy fund recipients need to document how they're complying with the requirement. We acknowledge that it's an added burden for them to demonstrate how their administrative expenses are, you know, directly related and necessary for, but that's part of the deal. That's part of the strings attached with this money. We made a recommendation to MMB that they provide some leadership and guidance for state agencies in terms of how to report and track their administrative expenses. And this fall, MMB did come out with some guidance for state agencies in terms of how to track the administrative expenses. And this was the point when I was going to segue to Ms. Ferkel, and she could get into the details of how they've been doing. So I guess you'll have to stay tuned for part two.
Okay.
And that wraps up my part, Madam Chair, related to this evaluation.
Okay. Any final questions from committee members? Okay. Remember, we don't have a meeting until the 23rd. And I'm not sure what we're going to do. At some point, I think we're going to want to hear from many of the people assembled in this room. We may do it by volunteer instead of by scheduling, but we'll see how that works.
Madam Chair, I don't want to fall back into the practice of giving homework assignments, as used to be the case. But I will simply refer. Well, if you want homeroom assignments, I have one, and that is these reports, which Ms. Ferkel was going to talk about, are available from us either in paper on our website. So if you want to get a little jump on her presentation and know the details and maybe sharpen some of your questions, there are reports out on our financial audit website under legacy, and there are, I think, now 7 of them, and we prepared a memorandum for you, which is in your packet, which summarizes not only the audit work that we did this year, last year, but the previous year. So
okay.
If you want to know what we are finding, you can go out and take a look at these reports.
Okay. Remember to committee members, anything you want saved, you should put in your save folder. I would strongly recommend that everything you got today you save, because we're continuing with it. And I strongly think that those principle and guides are going to be something, the legislative guide is going to be something that's useful to look at many times. So, but if you don't put it in the save folder, you don't guarantee that it's been saved. Okay, any last comments from anyone? Okay, great. Meeting adjourned.